We're really looking at software analysis tools, and in particular static and dynamic analysis tools. So we are funding work in the development of new tools for software analysis. Where the swamp comes in, and it's called the Software Assurance Marketplace because it really is a marketplace of tool developers. So if you think about a tool developer today, they might test their software package with one tool, might, that not all of them do, right? And so what we're doing in the swamp is providing an environment where developers, software developers, even people who are getting software from other places that would like to test it and validate it. And then what is in the swamp is a number of tools, some that are open source, some that we have funded. We even have a number of commercial vendors who have put their technologies into the swamp. So now I, as a software developer, can run my software against a large number of tools because every tool is going to do analysis differently, right? So if I run it against 10 different tools, that's a much better analysis than if I run it against just one tool. On the flip side, the real value here for the tool developers is now if I run 500 software packages a week through the swamp and their tool is being used to analyze all 500 packages, I now get a much better idea about how well that tool performs. So not only can we improve the quality of the software being written, we can now improve the quality of the tools being developed because now I can do some analysis on tool A versus tool B versus tool C and provide that back to either the open source community or to the commercial vendor and help them improve the quality of their tools.
How much is this being used? Are you seeing software developers coming to it and using the tools? Are you just at the beginning stages where you're just trying to get the word out? Because obviously this just on the surface sounds like something that would have a huge amount of value. And of course, is there a cost?
There's no cost. It's a research infrastructure that we're providing to the community for testing and evaluating software. It's been operational for about 7 months. We're already doing on average about 700 assessments per week software packages that are available. As I mentioned, we've brought in not only some of the government-funded tools and the open-source tools, we've also brought in some commercial tools as part of that. And as far as the user community, we're up at about 350 registered users that are using the swamp that are a mix of government, and academia, and industry. And we believe that it will continue to grow as the word gets out there and as people start to use it. And we will continue to improve the infrastructure to support the community.
As a good cybersecurity person, you're probably paranoid a little bit. So here's the paranoid question from the cynical reporter, right? Are the registered users people who have to go through a process of approval, or can anyone be a registered user? Because then how do you stop bad guys from seeing what you're testing against to then develop hacking software or whatever malware that can't be picked up by the software because they know what's being tested against? I know you know the circle, but help answer the question.
It is a circle, and we do have a vetting process, and we're working through that process. We have a complete security architecture associated with the swamp, and we monitor behavior of the evaluation process of a software package. So we would like to think that we have it orchestrated and architected well enough that if you're a bad guy trying to reverse engineer the system, we would be able to detect your behavior and be able to basically stop you from doing that. Nothing's perfect, as you know, in security, but we have gone through the process to try to ensure that the process and the architecture is as secure as it can be.
And I think that it's good to put that out there because I think people listen to this and go, well, this software assurance thing is great, but okay, now you're opening it up to everybody. So there's a vetting process, there's a security architecture for people so you guys can take a look at if there's a behavior that's an anomaly or that doesn't quite fit in with everyone else's behavior. What else has happened around software assurance? Because I think this is one of those areas that is of huge concern. They talk about supply chain management, risk management. They talk about how do you know that you're not buying a software title, commercial or other, that doesn't have backdoors in it. So this is one way. What are some other ways?
The vision from S&T is 5 years from now, the government wouldn't buy any software unless it had been approved through the swamp. Kind of almost like a good housekeeping seal of approval or an underwriter's lap. Don't know if we'll get there, but that's the idea. We want to be that serious about it. But I think there are other areas that we're thinking about and looking at. For example, the mobile applications analysis of that. It's not just the mobile applications. It's the whole software development process. Can we build better tools so that the software developers are using more secure software practices in their development process? You mentioned the supply chain. There's certainly a software supply chain issue. How do you ensure the software is as good as it can be? Certainly been a number of cases in the news recently, Heartbleed, the Bash, Shell Shock stuff, that is all points back to the quality of software. And as you know, one of the other areas we really look at closely, as I mentioned, is, you know, we're bringing in open source tools. We also look at open source software. And, you know, how do we, as the government and cost-saving measures goes towards using more and more open source, how do we ensure that that software is as good as it can be?
One of the other pieces around open source is the host program. I know that may not be a specific software assurance piece, but it is an open source piece. Talk a little bit about where host fits into this.
Yeah, so it is the Homeland Open Security Technology Program, and it is aimed at trying to ensure that those technologies that are made available to the government, first responder community, et cetera, which, you know, eventually make their way into the larger global community, that they're as secure as they can be from a security analysis perspective. So, you know, the way it fits in is not only do we help the community, but some of those things that we fund will end up as open source products. So we try to ensure that anything we, DHS or and the government, are putting out there from an open source perspective don't have any of these vulnerabilities. And so there's a really good connection between Swamp and Host from the standpoint of making sure that whatever we fund and work at in the open source community, we ensure that it is tied up closely with the software assurance capabilities as well.
So is Host an actual tool? So if I'm at agency X and I'm wanting to bring in some open source software to do a specific, meet my mission, I could potentially put that software through Host and then find out if there's some security vulnerabilities I need to deal with, or is it something else that's a repository of quote-unquote approved software?
So it's actually about three different things, one of which is the last item you mentioned, right, is this, can we be essentially the repository or the router that can point government agencies to vetted open source software? The second area is, in fact, looking at some of those processes for getting open source into the government. The government's not the most open source friendly sometimes. We most recently published a report on the challenges and the opportunities of open source software in government that has been made available on our website, and looking at some of the issues for adoption of open source within the government. And the third area is a focused investment of new projects in open source, or even existing projects that need security functionality added into those projects. We will consider some of those for additional funding to ensure that they are made more secure.
When it comes to open source, the report you talk about, and I'll make sure we link to that on federalnewsradio.com, because it seems to me that there's a broader or an easier take on open source. I think agencies are more comfortable moving in that direction. Is something like Host helping make that transition easier?
So Host is a fairly new initiative, but yes, well, that's how we intend to measure government uptake of open source. I still think the government has a long way to go with respect to open source. Even though you're seeing a little bit more of it, we've been working with an organization called GovReady, which is actually aimed at trying to help the government and some of the agencies and the CIOs and the CISOs be better educated on open source and its use in operational environments. And that's where we're trying to take the program, is to be kind of that hub of open source within the federal government.
Let me back up to identity management for a second, because obviously one of the thought processes behind HSPD-12 when it came to the PIV cards and the smart card was there's a biometric on it. A lot of agencies are using it as a two-factor. You put the card in, you enter your PIN and password. What kind of research are you guys doing to add that third and fourth factor, iris, thumbprint, fingerprint, or even the GPS? I think that's fascinating.
So we've done some work on the GPS work. In fact, one of our performers that was in the broad agency announcement, they're still doing some work here, University of Houston and also IBM, both working in this area. And they are also working with commercial vendors of devices. So we're making progress there. It's not quite done, but we're looking at the GPS issue. There's also, from a biometric perspective, looking at things like swipes and how do you swipe in order to open up for your password. And you'll swipe that way all the time. You can also look at things like gait. And, you know, how fast are you walking and what direction are you walking? So I can do all that. Well, we don't have a iris scanner on our phone that allows me to put it up to my eye. Maybe that's a CSI thing, but we need to go there from a pure biometrics perspective, but we haven't started anything in that area.
The insider threat, that's one of the things that we've seen a lot, is the White House spending a lot of time focusing on insider threat. There's a task force, there's a report. I think a lot of that is short-term and changes, policy, regulations, and not so much the technology behind it. Are you guys at S&T looking at the technology of the insider threat piece, or where is the research arm coming in to help support that other broader effort?
There are several. One is in the detection piece. So if I have a large quantity of data, how do I detect when someone's being abnormal? Part of this, of course, is very difficult because you're trying to capture a baseline. How much data do I have to gather in order to understand what your normal behavior is? And then I can actually tell Jason's being abnormal. And so there's that piece of it. So it's, you know, some data collection, it's the detection algorithms, it's the data analytics, all of that just to detect whether or not you're someone that I should monitor even more closely. So then you start talking about, how do I monitor? How do I ensure that I'm collecting the right kinds of data? There's certainly human resource angle to this as well that has to be considered as part of the process.